Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So the question with Djokovic is, okay, what now?
Yeah.
I don't remember being super stressed about seeing Nadal in the final. Because, you know, after 2011, that's like the one thing that you felt like, even if the 2011 US Open, that third set was, I really think that's where Nadal kind of had a, got a foothold again in the rivalry, because before that he was kind of lost, because even if at Wimbledon he won the set, that was not the same. It was, he was just not really there. And in a way that it was kind of shocking. So he shows up in the final. And at that point, I was thinking about this. He's won one Australian Open and Djokovic has won two. Like, that is as even as things could be back then.
Yes.
And he had played that Burdich match that you were mentioning, the long match. Then he beaten Federer. Not as tough as 2009.
Right.
But still. And he's there. He has this big brace in one of his knees, per usual. I don't remember being that stressed about it. And then I remember the experience of this whole match, because, you know, they started back then and lived on the East Coast, so 3:30 a.m.
Right.
And I just remember it being like a long slog, which obviously it almost lasted 6 hours. But it kind of, the match has had its own rhythm. It had this like very deliberate rhythm and everyone was taking their sweet time. And then I remember thinking that by the end, I mean, I thought Djokovic was probably dead at the end of that fifth set. When he goes down 4-2, you're thinking, this is, he's toast.
Yeah.
And then he's not.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess the narrative after that was like, well, yeah, he still has Nadal in his pocket, even if Nadal pushed it and had a lead in the fifth. And it was basically, oh, here he comes again. He's even stronger since he seemed frail and somehow ends up surviving semis and finals.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an underrated feat because, you know, Nadal has the famous one from 2009 where he does the semis and the finals, both five setters, both really long matches. And this technically was longer than
those. But by like an hour, I think.
Yes, yeah. Longer, but then the Nadal ones were more impressive just because I don't remember Murray playing anywhere near what Verdasco did to Nadal that day. It was not. It was just, you know, one of they're probably, I'm guessing it is, their longest slog of all the slogs that they played.
Yeah.
So coming out of the Australian Open, I remember that narrative and feeling like, okay, Djokovic is back to business. And then what happens? He doesn't win another slam until the next year.
Yeah, I mean, the insanely ironic thing is, like, this match helps Nadal mentally more than it helps Djokovic. Like, I still remember from your Rolling Stone piece when you linked to that video, and Nadal's like, yeah, I mean, winning in 2009 was great, but my best memory from this tournament is losing in 2012. I'm like, what are you talking about? How can that be your favorite memory? But I mean, it helped him. He won the next three after that, and I think like six out of the next seven or something. And the one he lost was that kind of surprising one at Monte Carlo, where Djokovic was just perfect and destroyed him. I mean, that's still so wild to me, because after the match, the commentators are going like, yeah, I mean, like the attitude seems to be like, that was a very brave performance by Nadal, but like, he's never going to get over the mental devastation of this. I think like Chris Fowler says like three times, this pain will stick with Nadal for the rest of his life. But it didn't really turn out that way, which is wild.
No. Yes. I mean, you can, I can hear Fowler saying that. And that's one of those things where, you know, I see the point. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it was dreadful.
Yeah.
But my guess is Nadal, and I don't know if sometimes in my personal experience, that I'm trying to do anything, say play the drums. And if there's a song that I want to play, and I try to play it, and I don't come close, then it's a feeling you get that you can see yourself doing it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Nadal got back in the fourth and the fifth set. Like,
yeah,
I think there is a way for me here, mm-hmm. even if it ended up not working in the end. Because that's the thing. I don't think Nadal played all that well that day.
No, I don't know if either of them did. Like, I think, I mean, one of the reasons why the match was such a slog was, like, not only was it 6 hours, but it took three for the match to actually get good. Like, they weren't good at the same time for three sets, which is why this isn't one of the greatest of all time.
No, and when people mention it, I'm like, no. And I think this is the classic match that definitely got better as it went along, but it took so long.
Yeah.
And then the fifth set, like the stuff that they did in that fifth set makes no sense.
Oh my God.
I mean, I think people who think that is one of the greatest matches ever probably just remember the fifth set.
Right. Yeah.
Because I would have people watch some of the crazy points they played in the fifth set. They make no sense. That made no sense if they would play those in the first set, but they played those in hour five.
Right. The fact that they do that, like, more, the closer they get to dropping, it makes no sense. Like, usually when players get tired, they shorten the points and they just went longer. It was crazy.
I think that's definitely the, like, I thought it was having the lead, but I think it's having the lead and being in it and forcing Djokovic, pushing him to the very end. Mm-hmm. That maybe told Nadal, you know what, there's a way here.
Yeah.
Because actually early in the match, I don't know if you got the same sense, but I felt like early in the match, Djokovic didn't really, it's a weird performance for him too. Like I think early on they're both kind of stiff and getting over their semifinals and they're just trying to get it together. But Djokovic is playing this final really aggressively. Like he's not really doing a whole lot of backhand jail. He's right. Just trying to attack all the time and he's not sharp, so he's missing a bunch.
Yeah, lots of inside out forehands that kind of sailed like wildly. In the first set it's really weird because like Djokovic's first three service games are a battle and he finally gets broken at 2-all and Nadal is like holding really easily. There's a point, and you see, like, even with, like, the commentators are saying, this is still close, even though Nadal is kind of playing well, and Djokovic is kind of not. And, like, you see that even with Djokovic playing really aggressively, there's nothing Nadal, like, there's nothing resembling the backhand jail he can put Federer in. And so he needs to try to do these things to give himself time, like maybe land a shot on the baseline, Djokovic has a half volley, and then he gets time, or, like, something he does a lot that eventually gets him into trouble is, like, he slices to Djokovic's backhand because Djokovic can't get as much pace on those. And then he attacks with the inside out forehand. And he kind of does that at like, I think 1-2, 15 all, they play a long point. And Nadal slices to his backhand. Djokovic hits like a slower one. And that lets Nadal like take a full swing, do the full like lasso, put the topspin on the ball, lands it right on the baseline, gets another weak ball, like hard inside out, and then eventually finishes with a smash. But it's like, he needs to construct the point to get those kinds of forehands because under normal circumstances, like Djokovic just doesn't give him time.
Yes. I like how I took notes. I don't know why I took notes, but I took like these long notes. I think it's like 5 pages of notes of the match just to steer those in my mind.
Send them to me after this.
Yeah. You can have them. Yeah. They're this one about that point you mentioned. I put the score wrong. It's 1-2, 15-all, the first holy shit moment.
Yeah.
And Djokovic half rolls his ankle. Like
right, yeah.
Because it was barely the, you know, he the way he moves somehow, he doesn't do this more often. But it was a little thing.
Yeah.
But it did feel in those, especially the first set, second set, Thurston is weird. Thurston, he, I mean, the,
that's Djokovic, Scott mode, Djokovic.
Like, yeah, he steamrolls him. And Nadal is kind of like, I don't know what to do here.
Yeah.
And he's just getting blasted. That's kind of like the 2019 final.
Yeah. That's, yeah.
Where it's just when Djokovic is hitting the ball that early, that cleanly,
yeah,
and into those targets, that's it.
Yeah.
No one can do anything. Nobody. That's just how it is.
Yeah.
But in the first three sets, it feels like Nadal, I wrote something about how it almost feels like he feels 2011, like he's carrying 2011. Yeah. Like, I don't think he fully believes. And he's doing this thing that we see with other players where when they play, especially one of these guys, mm-hmm, where you see them like trying to go for stuff for too much.
Yeah.
And then Nadal was like really frustrated with himself when he would miss. It's almost like he knew that his margin of error was
right
small.
It's like if Djokovic even starts to play a little bit better, like this set gets away from me.
Exactly. You get the sense for the first four sets that, yeah, if Djokovic just settles into something resembling consistent good play, this is over. Because yeah, there's these times where he just steps in, blasts stuff into one corner, blasts stuff in the other corner.
And yeah, like,
what is Nadal supposed to do?
Yeah.
And Nadal's playing with his mindset, but I do think that surviving the fifth set, the fourth set, because Nadal had no chances.
Yeah.
Like in the broadcast, they don't mention this, but even in the second set, that break when he breaks Djokovic, when Djokovic is trying to serve for the yeah set.
I mean, Djokovic breaks himself. Like,
yeah, and it came out of nowhere. Like, Nadal yeah played two good points. The rest
yeah
of it is just
exactly
Djokovic being,
I mean,
doing his thing.
Yeah, and that's a stretch that really highlights how much of an advantage Djokovic had in the matchup, because he's got 40-15. And from there, it takes both a complete implosion from Djokovic and Nadal blasting his forehands down the line and a double fault from Djokovic. And then he yes gets the break. Like, you need all of these things to happen at the same time. And I mean, like, yeah, he breaks, but it's, I mean, it feels very, very tenuous all the time.
Yes. You feel like that came out of nowhere. And then yeah the very next game, Djokovic, like, gets back on track. Like, yes, let's fix this mistake right now,
right,
because I can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's now the first set, Djokovic is just so mediocre in that set that Nadal should have won at 6-4.
Like, oh, absolutely. Yeah.
There's no reason why he didn't. He just played a really terrible game at 4-3?
Yeah.
Or 3-all, I think. Just the dreadful 4-3.
Yeah.
Dreadful game. No reason that he played that. And then, you know, the set extends. But that's actually, let's get into this thing that you're talking about narratives.
Yeah.
The big narrative coming out of this match was that these guys take too long, we need to do something, which
right
is classic ATP that you
God
now have lived through with the bathroom gate
yeah
and all that nonsense. Classic overreaction to a very specific, to one person or at most two people.
Yeah.
Like changing a rule for everybody based on two people.
Right.
It made no sense. It made no sense. But there was this huge outcry. And they start mentioning it in the match. And my theory, it's funny because you hear it at the end of the first, at the end of the second, at the end of the third. The reason is simple. It's because it's taking so long and it's not very good.
Right.
But then at the end of the fifth,
like
no one
cares
anything
anymore. Yeah, exactly.
Everyone's been like, this is one of the best matches. Like Fritz right Stolle says, this is one of the best matches I've ever seen. I'll never forget this. Like, I think you've already forgotten
the first three sets. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And it's hilarious because like you said, after everyone loves it. Like the chairman guy, like during the trophy ceremonies, like if there are ever two athletes that deserve a standing ovation, it's these two. And like everyone is so into it. I'm just like,
well,
and also like
it, obviously, because
yeah,
they're pushing Nadal
and
four set.
Right.
They want more.
And like you said, like this is only ever going to happen with these two guys. Like even when one of them is flying, the other one's faster. Like it's,
yeah.
I think I've rarely agreed with a tweet more than like, I think during the French Open match, you tweeted like, I think for matches between these two, just ditch the shot clock because they both take a long time. And like, they're both doing these crazy things and people expect them to do them on less time. And I'm like, yeah, like they're both slow. Just let them do whatever they want. Tennis is amazing.
Yes. That has always been my point. And the funny thing is this will surprise you.
Yeah.
But what I realized is that the biggest winner of this match was none other than Pascal Maria, who was the umpire.
Uh-huh.
Because for God's sakes, it's his job to monitor this thing. He
yeah
didn't do anything.
Oh my god!
Anything.
He's one of the best. Like the line calling was bad in this match. Djokovic gets pissed off because so many calls missed
a bunch of times.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and even Pascal was barely overruling anything.
Right.
The line judges were a disaster, especially at the baselines.
Yeah.
Just and consequential points. That's one where you want to go back to the people who are like lamenting the loss of lines. You go,
right.
No,
this is what happens. Yeah.
Get him out of there.
Yeah. Nadal, it happened when Nadal serving 4-5 in the second, he had a game point for 5-all. Djokovic nails a return on the baseline, called out. Like that would have made it 5-all in the second set. And thankfully he challenges and that gets fixed because that could have really swung the match.
Well, and Pascal Maria is the biggest winner, I think, because after this match, no one said, man, Pascal Maria really should have done something about the pace.
Yeah.
Because here's what I did. I was one of those people. Because I'm watching that first set, and I'm watching it on YouTube, and YouTube gives us this wonderful thing of like being able to go 5 seconds, which is
it's peak absolutely modern mandatory. Humankind. Yeah.
Like you cannot watch this in real time.
Yep.
Don't do it. And something I'm noticing that I'm having to click a lot of times.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay. So I have second set. First point of Nadal's opening service game. So Djokovic already held.
Yeah.
Double fault. Nadal takes 22 seconds from when Pascal Maria called the score to get to the service line. 35 seconds for the serve. And I'm thinking, what the heck, Pascal? I'm not saying like keep them to the, and people should know, people listening to this that maybe don't remember.
Yeah.
But, you know, tennis is a big, giant clusterfuck of everything. And this time rule was the epitome because the ITF had one, the ATP had another. I don't know. And the ITF one made no sense. The Slam one made no sense. It was 20 seconds.
Like
they said it in 1960 and forgot about it because it wasn't a problem. It was never a problem until this match when, there's a certain gentleman who was not in this match, plays very quickly, very influential, and was getting kind of kicked out of prominence.
Who could you possibly be talking about, man?
Who can this be? Many connections, we have to do something about this. Yeah, you know what you do? You tell the umpire to do his job.
Right.
Do your damn job, Pascal Maria. Tell them, guys, speed it up. You're taking like 35 seconds. And at one point, they do say in the broadcast, I think it's, at the beginning of set three. Because again, we've been on court for like 2.5 hours and got two sets in that weren't good. So people are saying, they're saying Djokovic is taking 30 seconds and all 34.
33,
And it's nuts. Because, the rule is 20. And Pascal Maria has not said anything. Yeah. He's done nothing. And he was a good umpire. He was in a lot of great matches, and he was one of the better ones. He's a disaster in this match for what you said about the line calling that was bad and he didn't do anything. The one I was really mad about was in the fifth set where Djokovic hits one on the sideline. And this is where I'm always harsh on the umpires. Like, if they don't overrule with something that's on the other corner, I get it. It's far away. It's hard to see. But that line, you're right on that line. Yeah. That's your line. And Pascal doesn't overrule it. And Jericho is just looking at him like, what are you doing? You're making me use a challenge in the fifth set? Like, my God. Like, it honestly felt like Pascal was in a coma or that he needed to go to the bathroom because he just seemed like he was asleep. I mean, and the thing is, it was hot. Like they say, it was hot.
Yeah.
It was, they say it in centigrade, but I think it was like 31 degrees after the second set. And then it barely went down because it's so hot and humid in Australia. And you can see it, not even, obviously Nadal is sweating, but he would be sweating anywhere. But Djokovic is sweating. And then you see the crowd shots and everybody's like shiny because it's just humid. So there is that. But oh my God, Pascal Maria, he must be so relieved that no one came out with the right take after this.
Right.
Because and me included, I figured this out now.
Yeah.
10 years after the fact. Because at the moment I was making the argument you made. Like this was a great thing. This was a good thing. People are raving about this match. The people who are not raving about this match and complaining about this match, about how long it was, tend to be fans of a certain other player who was not involved in that match.
Yeah.
So let's put it in perspective. This was good. And, you know, very easy to prove. Everyone's reaction afterwards, that was in there, the crowd's reaction. I mean, it's not difficult, but all of this was so easy to solve. It's just telling the guys, this was too long.
Right. Like Pascal, both of you as well. Like what,
the only two. Yeah. We're the only two. The other one who is kind of that slow is Del Potro, but that's it. Everyone else plays fast. No one else. Like, I know that it's so funny now that Cilic ended up taking that ball bouncing thing. He didn't do that before. Tennis players are weird, but this was not a problem, and they made it a problem because it was so prominent on this stage, as if there weren't a rule and there weren't a person on court supposed to take care of this. But he didn't do anything. He, in the whole match, I mean, yes, I was fast forwarding, but I'm very sure he didn't say a single thing to either of them. Mm-hmm. And that's his fault. In the first set, it's his fault because, and that's been my whole beef with this stupid rule to begin with, when they actually instituted it and everything, is that they would call it in the fourth set. It's like, call it early, set the tone so that you know they're going to do it. Don't show up in like crucial part of the fourth set and call a time violation.
Right, because they did that in the French Open semifinal. Like, Djokovic is down break point, up a break in the third. Like, hugely pivotal moment. And I remember she calls the time violation, and you just tweeted, like, not you, Ava.
And she did it. Like, oh, my God. Like, we were fine. Like, that match was moving on. No one is claiming that they're taking too long. It was fine. Just relax. But no, what happened? What happened, Owen? What happened? Idiot tennis being stupid. Big brouhaha. I mean, this really, if you think about it, it makes bathroom gate nothing. Because everybody all of a sudden had to buy those stupid clocks.
Right.
And now we have the clocks that are not an issue 99% of the time.
Yeah.
Because of this match. Because people couldn't figure out, oh, we need a new rule. Actually, we have a rule. And we have someone to enforce it. He just didn't do his job.
Right.
And Pascal Maria just goes unscathed. He escaped. He's the biggest winner of this match.
So someone should write a book about this.
Oh, I didn't tweet it because I was saving it for here. But when this goes up, I'm tweeting the crap out of that.
All right.
Freaking Pascal Maria.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
No one ever made that point.
This is
his job.
You're going to break his heart because he says in like the whole strokes of genius thing, like, the umpire's job is to go unnoticed. I think you've just
unnoticed. He didn't do anything. And the thing is, he doesn't even have to do it during points. At the changeover, just tell them, guys.
Yeah.
Move it up. And look, I would have told them, look at that first set.
Yeah.
There's no reason.
80 minutes. Set. Yeah.
That is not an 80-minute set. That's a 55-minute set. Like, guys, come on. Second set, that's a 45-minute set. But I know you guys play long points. I know you guys are slow, but that's the thing. Like, after Nadal does something like at the beginning of the first set, the second set, which, hey, if people want to yell at me, go look at it. You can find it. First point, first service game, double fault after he had one let. So he served three times, goes to the towel. Towel off again, even though Djokovic just held.
I mean, as we know, double faults are really tiring, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, you got to swing the racket a whole two times.
Yes, three times. He did.
Oh,
he did
that's right.
Maybe that's why he took that long.
The third swing triggered a new sweat gland or something. I don't know.
Yes. 35 seconds to serve. I mean, he was past the rule. He didn't even get to the service line. And then afterwards, he's between 30 and 35. Djokovic between 25 and 30. But for some, and that's Pascal's thing. He should have, that first set. I mean, I don't know how you are sitting there. And this is why I think I'm also harsher on tennis umpires than most other referees. Because like the NBA guys and gals, because they have both, they have a super hard job. Like those are giants moving at the speed of light.
Right.
In a very small space. Good luck seeing anything. You know, and they mess it up. But, and also they have to run. The soccer guys and gals are incredible. because, well, I mean, the main one, the head one, because the other one's just, you know, running every once in a while on the line. But the main one has to cover the whole court, the whole field, with incredible athletes running incredibly fast. Yeah. So there's that.
In tennis, you have a chair elevated like a billion feet above the court.
It's just sitting there. Sitting there, typing on an electronic screen. That's all they're doing. Like, for God's sakes, how do you finish that first set, look at the clock that's right there, and be like, man, these guys need to ramp it up. I'm falling asleep here. Yeah, you fell asleep. We all noticed it. Well, actually, no one noticed it, Pascal. He got away with it for so long. Anyway.
No, that was a very fun rant to listen to.
You didn't see that one coming. I say
no, not at all. Well done.
I've been stewing on this since I started watching it, because I saw the first set 2 days ago, and then I saw the rest yesterday. And I saw the first set. I'm like, for God's sakes, what the heck?
Yeah,
this is just taking so long for no reason. And yeah, he just let them. And he had the power. He had the rule. He could have done something.
Yep.
But no, this is peak tennis. I mean, really, the bathroom stuff is nothing compared to this, because it became a narrative for years. Because which tournament was going to, well, coming up with the rule, coming up with 25 seconds, everyone agreeing on the 25 seconds. This was a multi-year idiocy. Just for God's
sake. Could have just said, like, hey, like, there's a rule. Use, like, enforce it, please. Or
I feel
remind
like
them
now,
of it.
Now, in this year, like 2022, or after the 2021 season, I feel like it was less of an issue. Like, it was less of a problem. Like, the one you mentioned at the French Open was, like, thankfully, we didn't really get in the way of stuff.
Yeah.
But now when it happens, you're kind of like, because, you know, people have adjusted. Players know they can't take that long.
Yeah.
And then the umpires have become less draconian.
Right.
Because they were the a-holes who would start the clock after a long point, immediately before they even call the score. And then the crowd's going nuts. How many times have you seen a highlight, or if you're watching and rewatching a match, where crazy point, crowd goes nuts, players, you know, take their little bit of time.
Yeah.
And then as the player is about to serve and the crowd is still making noise, they get a time violation. It's like,
right.
No, now they know that after a long point, they should let people settle down. Take a while to call the score. Let's be reasonable.
Right. I mean, I think the way to do it is, like, change the number of seconds based on rally length. You know, like, if it goes above 10 shots, add 5 seconds or something like that.
And you don't even need to count. Just see, oh, long point. Guy's tired.
Yeah. Like, unless it's really insane, like what Lendl used to do. Like,
He was, they were talking about that in the broadcast, that he took 28 seconds, apparently. 28, not 27, not 30, 28.
Brad Gilbert said in his book that sometimes Lendl would take like 50 seconds if he was losing. He'd just completely kill the pace of the match. But I mean, the one thing I'll say in Pascal's defense is, like, I understand the impulse not to want to interfere with a match, especially if it's a final, and especially if, like, something special is happening. But at the same time, like, something special was not happening at the end of the first set. Like, if it's the fourth and it starts to become a problem, I get it. Don't say anything. Like, don't interrupt this spectacle. But I mean, early on, I think if he had just said, like, hey, guys, both of you, like, speed up, please, then I can't see how that goes wrong.
My guess is that's the thing. This really wasn't much of a thing. I mean, yes, people made fun of and noticed how Nadal had his long thing. But in classic tennis fashion, I remember clearly that there were people who praised him because it was like taking control of the match and whatever. And, you know, he has all his convoluted tics and routines.
Yeah.
But these guys played so many times a year before, and this was not an issue.
Right.
And I think the only reason it happened here was because of heat.
Right.
They were both tired. They played a long route to the final. It was a hot night. It was muggy. Pascal probably thought, you know what, guys, just do whatever.
Right.
Take your time. I'm not gonna be like, hey, move it when it's so hot and you guys are playing these points and have played so much. But I do think that there was a happy medium ground where he should have done the bare minimum.
Yep.
And not let this spiral out of control. Because actually, it's out of control after the first set.
Yeah. So I mean, I can't argue with that. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I mean, and the first set is kind of short of all these holy shit moments. I mean, you get another one at Djokovic serving it 2-2 deuce, and he approaches the net off kind of a so-so approach shot. Mm-hmm. And Nadal hits the pass right at him. Djokovic hits a good volley. And I've watched this with multiple commentators. All of them like either start talking or take their eye off the point. Nadal somehow like flaps his racket at this thing and it squirms over the net. And then passes Djokovic on the next shot. And it's, I mean, that get might be the individual shot of the match for me. I don't know how he got that thing back, but
no, that was nuts. I wrote insane defending from Nadal for the first break point at 2-2.
Yeah, and you want to know a crazy fact about this match is, I mean, Nadal blows this break point with horrible second serve return. And that is the only break point Djokovic will save until the last game of the match. And that is both because Nadal's not getting any break points. And when he does, Djokovic plays terribly.
Well, yeah, but he double faulted one.
Yeah, you have two easy backhand down the line misses. And then you have a short shot in the fifth that he hits to Nadal's forehand and gets burned immediately. And that's all of them.
Actually, I forgot that I meant to write this and I remember I never did. But one of the cool things about this match is actually the camera work is very nice because we get a lot of like the lower angle. And that miss, it was a really bad miss because it was a second serve on break point.
Yeah.
But you can see the action on Djokovic's serve. Because it actually jumps on Nadal, and Nadal has to hit it way higher than he thought he would have to.
Yeah.
But you see these little details.
Right.
And some of the rallies that you see on that camera are so nice when, you know, when they play actually a good one. But no, you're right. To me, my favorite shot of the match after watching it again, I have forgotten about it.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in the fourth fourth or the fifth, where, the fifth set, probably one of the greatest Nadal forehands of all time.
Is this falling backwards,
inside out? No.
The third point of the match.
He's falling backwards.
Yeah.
Backwards. Djokovic is on that side of the court, and he still blasts this thing.
Yeah, like 101 miles an hour or something.
Made no sense.
Yeah.
I watched it a couple of times. Like, how the heck did he do that?
Yeah.
It was at 15-all. Yeah, third point of the fifth set. For some reason, this match also had this, I don't know if you noticed, but a lot of the sets started with really good points.
Yeah, I mean, the first point of the fifth set, I wanted to talk about, because that's like, that's peak Nadal. He changes the direction of the ball on every shot, and then he finishes with like a really slow inside-in winner. And then immediately just yells Vamos. And I'm like, it looks like he's going to win the set. I mean, we'll get to that eventually. That was, and the start of the fourth as well, the second point that they play is one of the best points of the match.
The second point, that one I just wrote ridiculous stuff at love 15-0-0.
Yeah.
And the other one I wrote, first point is a tone setter, blistering Nadal forehand winner after a long rally. I mean, yeah, it was, you're thinking, wow, okay, this is happening.
Yeah.
But yeah, this match is a trip. And honestly, I would tell people, because I think my stance after when it happened was, you know, a lot of this wasn't that good. The end was great. And then I think I watched it again. I thought, you know, it's an interesting watch. And yes, just the end, the fourth and the fifth are good. Yeah. Now I would say the fourth is okay.
Yeah.
I would probably start watching in the game where Djokovic is up love 40, where you think this is going to happen.
I would watch the first two games of the fourth, because that's when Nadal really actually gets his teeth into the match for the first time and like hits some decent first serve returns. But I kind of had the same feeling when I was watching the fourth. Like the narrative is that it's just an amazing set. But I think between 1-1 and that 3-4 game, like nothing really happens.
There is kind of just motors along. But then that 3-4 game is nuts because stuff Djokovic does to get to love 40 is ridiculous. Some of his returning in this match is just absurd what he's doing.
I mean
second serves sure, but he's putting some first serve returns that you're like, what is anybody supposed to do with that?
It doesn't make sense. I mean, this is jumping way ahead now, but I mean, you probably noted this, but the 5-all 30-all point in the fifth, Nadal hits a first serve out wide, Djokovic blasts the return at Nadal's feet, and this guy is so tired, he can't get out of the way of the ball. He volleys it back from the baseline. Like, this return does not bounce. He volleys it from the baseline. It's an unintentional serve and volley from the baseline, and then it devolves into this 19-shot rally, and Nadal has to run like a mile and a half and cramps at the end. I mean, you can't write this stuff. It's crazy.
Yes. This is the one that I wrote, Jesus, in capital letters, the 30-all point. How? After 5.5 hours, break point again, but really, how are they hitting the ball like this?
Right.
That makes no sense. I mean, that's just one of those where you're like, this is just a gift. But, oh, man. Well, I don't know if you noticed that. This was the fun watch for me. I mean, it was interesting in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Like, watching Nadal be just not as good as I thought he was.
Yeah.
Just visibly worse than the 2009 version. Just not getting a lot of depth. Mm-hmm. Backhand kind of stiff. Like, he hits a lot of good ones, but also a lot of like not great ones.
Yeah.
But it just seems like he can't find the good medium of penetration with the weight of shot. So he's always struggling, either too much spin and it lands too short, or he tries to flatten it and he goes way long. Because he has some backhand misses and some forehand misses that are not close. Like, he's missing by a lot. So you think that you see that his game is not close to being in tune.
No. And I think the reason why for me is like, Djokovic is just the worst possible matchup for him. Like, when you watch him up to the final, he's so razor sharp, like against Berdych. He's hitting these forehands and like return winners and these ridiculous passes. And then he kind of does the same thing against Federer. But it's like against Djokovic, I think the commentators are kind of confused that you don't see any of these like insane passes or like forehand winners down the line on the run. And it's like, he's not being allowed to hit them is the thing. Like, he needs, his forehand is such a fascinating shot to me. Cause like, when it has time, the things that forehand will do, it's like, he can go anywhere. But when it doesn't have time, like, you can attack the hell out of that wing. And so like, and he just never has time. And so one of the things I noticed when watching this match is like the forehand winner he hits to save set point, like the second set point at the end of the second set to get it back to deuce at 3-5. After that, between that point and 2-all in the fourth set, he hits one forehand winner. Wow. One forehand winner the entire time. Like, Djokovic has neutralized his game so much. And so I'm like, I'm watching Nadal and I'm like, he's not doing anything. Like, he's falling behind on every single point, but you can almost hear him thinking like, I'm trying, but I can't. Like, there's nothing I can do here. Because the way he can get into the matchup against Djokovic is like hit down the line to break the cross court pattern. But if you don't have time, you can't do that.
You can't do it from the Melbourne letters.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is where he was most of the time.
Right. And so, like, even late in the match, there's one point when Djokovic has hit 31 forehand winners and Nadal's hit 20. And like, and the forehand is probably the one thing right at this moment that Nadal does better, right? And yet it's been completely neutralized. And this third set, I think, is just like you were saying, it's just an illustration of like, he can't do anything. Like, I mean, no one can, but I mean, kind of Nadal in particular. Like, he wins two points on the return. He gets broken. He loses 8 straight points at the end of the set. He hits one forehand winner. I think he forces one error with it. But like, you're watching these points and it's just like every single point he's on the run. And I mean, we say the third set at the US Open was kind of when he got a foothold, but I think he lost it like during the third set, and he had to kind of get it again in the fourth set. Like, for me, that fourth set is when it's like, okay, like I'm going to go down swinging. But before that, he looks as lost as I've ever seen him. He was
lost.
Crazy.
And the commentators mentioned that, like, he's lost.
Yeah.
The funny thing is that the commentator Stolle says that after the first, he thinks Nadal's winning in straights because he doesn't think Djokovic is like, he thinks Djokovic is done physically and Nadal looks okay. And I'm like, I would say that.
Like, at least wait 20 minutes. I mean,
yes. And then he starts making fun of his prediction, which is funny.
Okay. Well, good for him. That puts him above the likes of McEnroe and Arias, at least.
Yeah, because they forget whatever they say immediately. Right. But no, yeah, Stolle was funny because he was saying, oh, I thought this was done and dusted. And then he thought it was done and dusted the other way, which honestly most people thought it was done and dusted. Yeah. I mean, when it was 3-4 or left 40, then
this ends. Right. I think even before then, like after the third set, it just looks like impossible because the ESPN people, I mean, I think you generally as a commentator try to maintain some suspense. Like you don't want to ruin the movie and say like this player is winning this, but like they kind of, I think Chris McHenry says like, you know, Brad is saying if Nadal doesn't redline, like this is done. And it was very emphatic, and it's not usually like that during a match, kind of regardless of who's playing.
The third set, I did the stats for each set, but apparently I didn't do them after set three because I don't know, it was too quick.
Yeah.
But no, that's the thing. And actually Nadal says it in the comment during the broadcast, they mentioned that Nadal said that 2011, the biggest thing was he felt like Djokovic took his time away. That's the thing. He took that. It's two things. These are things that so many people that watch tennis don't even really understand how they work, but you take people's time away when you hit on the rise and you hit deep, which is what Djokovic can do. But that is also the hardest thing to do in tennis. Like that is violently hard to do. Somehow Djokovic can do that against anybody.
But he's the only one. That's it.
No one can do it. The funny thing is the guy who can do it every once in a blue moon is Schwartzman.
Yeah.
When he actually, he's just, you know, obviously different category of player.
Yeah.
But that match when he beats Nadal in Rome, it's basically because of that, because he's just taking the ball on the rise all the time and stepping in, because obviously he's so short.
He has to play
all the time.
Yeah.
Either he makes it or not. I mean, otherwise, what? Is he going to run behind and wait until the ball drops?
Yeah.
But I don't think, and this was, I think, the shock for Nadal in 2011, even though Djokovic played like that a little bit, I don't even think Djokovic necessarily understood that that was the key.
Mm-hmm.
That this thing that no one could do to Nadal, certainly not Federer,
right?
Unless it was a low bouncing fast court.
Yeah.
If you take Nadal's time away, things become much easier because you get Nadal running and you get Nadal back. And if he's in the back, sure, he might pass you a couple of times because that's just how he is.
Yeah.
He might get back in the point a couple of times, but you have him not completely neutralized, but you have him in a position that's more comfortable, and you reduce the kind of shots that you want to hit too. Like that reduces the degree of difficulty. So, and that was the key. And that's actually the key to the past, the French Open semifinal, like the most recent famous of their matches, mm-hmm. You could see early on that Djokovic was hitting the ball early. And he said that he was hitting the ball well, so that's why he had confidence that he could get in the match. I mean, I can't imagine how hard that is. Like, if anybody has ever played tennis against someone who hits the ball with heavy topspin, I remember, you know, I'm a very bad tennis player that haven't even played that much, but I remember when I was learning, there's this guy, and I learned on clay, on proper red clay, not in the US, but in Ecuador. And there was this guy who was at the club, and he hit the ball with like massive topspin.
Yep.
And I remember just seeing how this ball, the moment it hits the clay, just it's like it explodes off of it. And obviously the natural instinct is not to cut it off it. It's to fall back.
Yeah. And wait for it to drop in moonball or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
how do you do that? I don't know how you do that.
It's like hitting a basketball or a medicine ball or something. Yes. And I think that like another thing that made Djokovic such a nightmare for Nadal is like, even when Nadal does get time on the forehand, he doesn't win the point all the time because Djokovic can defend like him. Like there are a couple of points like that second point in the fourth set when Nadal gets his inside out forehand going and he's just bombing shot after shot into Djokovic's forehand and Djokovic gets them all back. And then eventually he reads one, gets it deep, and then he's on top of the point. And it wasn't like that against Federer because Federer would slice and it's over. Or like, I mean, he wasn't that much worse defensively, like still very good, but that didn't really happen with him. Kind of another smaller thing that Djokovic did was like, since he was winning these baseline points, he never needed to come to the net. So like he could be very selective with his approach shots. Whereas if you're Federer, you want to get away from the baseline you're going to hit some approach shots that aren't ideal and get passed. And like Djokovic, I mean, there's one point, like Nadal serving 1-4, 15 all in the second. And Djokovic approaches off like a very good inside out forehand that kind of hits the baseline. And he still gets passed, like can barely get a racket on it. And it's like, but he doesn't need to do that because he wins from the baseline. So he can just, he can just stay back. And so with and all of this, I was just gonna say with all of this in mind, it's like, he's blunted all of Nadal's like strengths. There's very little to fight back with after that.
Not only that, but so if you're the Federer-Nadal thing, you know, people always said, you know, the forehand to the backhand, and that was how he did it. Sure. But the main key was Nadal. I mean, that was the main key, but an underrated part of this whole dynamic was that Nadal was able to hit against Federer pretty mediocre backhands down the line.
Yes.
And not pay. At all. It's like he had him neutralized because he just put him in that corner without his forehand, and Federer just couldn't make him pay. Because that was the thing with Federer. The way out of that backhand is you got to take it early and you got to be aggressive. Otherwise, he's going to keep him there, which ironically is what Djokovic did to Nadal too. Nadal has the same the same situation. Like, oh, I hit one of those crappy backhands on the line at Djokovic, I'm dead because the ball is flying to the other corner immediately and consistently. But with Djokovic, with if you're Nadal and you're playing Djokovic, it's like, where do you go?
Yeah, exactly.
What is the plan here?
Yeah, and that's I think that's why he ended up overusing that slice because you know, when he hit it well and it stayed low to the backhand, it would work. But over time, he stops hitting it as well, and Djokovic runs around it, hits an inside out forehand, and Nadal is screwed because he's on the run and he can't get back in the point. I think the reason like he overuses that, it's like, what the hell else am I supposed to do? Like, I mean, if this doesn't work, what else is there? And I,
what he's tried is, did you see the kind of moon balls that he tried in 2011? And again,
last year? And those got eaten up as well.
Well, 2011 was hilarious. He did it in Rome.
This
was
on the set point of the first set. Do you remember that?
I think you remember it more clearly than I did, but I remember that match of just those weird, weird moon balls, which were a technical innovation from Madrid to Rome, which for those of you listening and thinking he got the order wrong, no, back then they were in that order. He was like, what is he doing with these weird moonballs? They did not work at all. Just got destroyed. The ones this year worked a little better because the thing with those is you got to get them deep, so they he can't have volley them, he can get them off the air, but he has to wait until they land. But even if he hits them early, he's hitting from the baseline,
right?
But back in 2011, he didn't do it. But I mean, yeah, that's the kind of thing that you start doing when you run out of options.
Yeah.
And you, I think all tennis players love, and it's easy in the vast majority of cases, there's a side you know where you can go that is safer. Like against Murray, you're obviously going to hit to the forehand.
Right.
If you get a chance against any player, you can easily pick a side. But against Djokovic, that's always been tricky because, yeah, his forehand tends to go off every once in a while, but do you really want to play there?
Like, not enough to ever really make a difference. Like, it's kind of the similar thing with, like, I mean, and Jim Courier, I think, said this, and no one ever says this, with which bothers me, but, like, his smash. They're saying, like, you know, he's a perfect player, except, like, his smash is a little iffy. And Jim Courier goes, like, yeah, but you can't beat someone by feeding them smashes. Like, that's like you're gonna get destroyed 90% of the time, and like maybe you get one miss or something. I mean, and in that Roland Garros semi last year, Djokovic smashed really well. Like, I think he missed one, two, made like 13 or something. Like, it's not like a smash. Like, you're no one's gonna self destruct by missing smashes.
No,
yeah.
Well, also, it's just there are entire matches where people hit what, five,
four? It's not, it's a nothing, not like a forehand,
No. Yeah, but good luck having a bad backhand. Like,
right,
that is more of a problem. Or if you can't return, like, oh, it's so I mean, different.
It's the plague on the ACP right now.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the thing is with Djokovic is that, yeah, people don't make that point. Like, there's no obvious way to go.
Yeah.
Especially if he's playing at a decent level. Where do you go?
Yeah.
And I think the only way you can create a short ball is if you get him on the move, just which is you do against all the good movers, like get him on the move, and maybe one of those shots in the run is going to land a little short and you're going to get a better chance to attack, which is what Djokovic does to pretty much everybody.
Yeah.
He puts him and the way he destroys Nadal's second serve in this match.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I mean, it should carry a not safe for work warning on it. It's just, he's on it. But the funny thing is, did you notice that Nadal was serving to the body? And actually, early on, he's getting a lot of good result.
Yeah.
Because that was the thing with them.
Yeah. Back like then. When he tries to consolidate the break at 3-2 in the first, he goes to the body a lot and he gets two or three easy plus ones. I think in the 4-5 game in the second as well, he's down 15-30 and he hits like consecutive body serve service winners. And then after that he gets destroyed. But like it was working for a bit.
It was not.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, like this matchup, like Nadal is bad for a lot of this match, but like it's like coming into the match, was playing so well. Like I don't think he's playing bad because it's like a shortcoming on his part. I think he's playing badly because he has to. Like there are points where he has really no other choice. And it's a credit to him.
I wouldn't say that he's bad. I would say he's not good enough.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, you know it, he knows it, and Djokovic knows it. And that is the worst place to be.
Yeah.
When you think you have to play at a super high level just to make it competitive.
Right.
Whereas the other guy's like,
I can play at a C level and still beat you.
And that's the thing that I don't think people have realized. Like, so Djokovic does this to Nadal. Mm-hmm. He does that to Federer. Federer does that to Nadal. But what do both of them do to him? Like, what is one thing that Federer and Djokovic and Nadal do to Djokovic that gets him in that comfort zone?
Right.
And for Federer, it's like serve out of a tree, which he has done. Yeah. When he dominates on serve, he has
slice
more of a chance.
But yeah.
But with Nadal, well, what does he do?
Yeah.
And I think that's the key to Djokovic's success in their head to head, is that he doesn't need to change.
Yeah.
He could just do his thing.
Yeah. And in
this match where he's technically completely undisciplined. Mm-hmm.
Like it's fine. Yeah. I mean, that first set, I think he hits like 19 on force errors. Like he is god awful. And yet 7-5 and the last game went to deuce. Like
19 on force errors, 1-5 on break points.
Oh god.
Lost 6. Yeah. He had 4 aces. 51% first serve percentage.
Yeah, I mean the irony is I think 3 of those aces are in the game where he gets broken. Like which is crazy. But yeah, I mean I think something people maybe don't appreciate is that this matchup Nadal against Djokovic is I don't know if it's as bad, but I think in a lot of ways it's maybe a little bit worse than Federer against Nadal, because at least Federer can hit his forehands to Nadal's backhand. Like that's a relative comfort zone. He has the serve. But Nadal against Djokovic, there is no one pattern that ever works consistently. It's
no. Just hoping that Djokovic is off the boil.
Yeah, and it's amazing that all this considered, like, I mean, I know Nadal had that start like 14-4 before Djokovic was totally fully formed, but like how the hell is he 28-30 against this guy?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
and not like 15 and 40. 28. It's 28 amazing.
Wins. No one else has 28.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's that is the thing. I mean, he has the, how many of these have been on clay? I think most of them.
18. I think 18 and then two on grass.
You
would
absolutely know this. What can I see surface? I'm on there it is. So yeah, on clay it's 27. Right. 27 out of the 58.
Yeah.
Hard is 27. It's actually now pretty completely equal. And grass is 4.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's, when you split them up, I mean, that's the thing. These guys, the one thing that Djokovic does not have, then would it make it like even more of an issue against Nadal, is when his point ending shots, when he's not taking it early, don't have the pace of like a big weapon.
Yeah.
And you can see it actually in the fourth set because he's taking the ball late and he's not, that's how he loses the tiebreaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, because his forehand completely implodes, like three errors in the last 5 points or something.
Exactly. And it's because he's not trying to hit early. He gets these short balls, but instead of attacking them quickly, he like loads up and goes for like the corner and misses. Mm-hmm. That is the one thing I think gives Nadal an in, because Federer, that's what Federer has. That's why Federer has had, you know, a good number of wins against Nadal. He has that, even though he has probably the worst wing of the three.
Yeah.
Like the backhand wing. He has the biggest weapon of the three. He has the forehand where he can, if he gets a short ball, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Whereas if you give Djokovic a short ball, he will hurt you, but you have a chance maybe.
Yeah.
You have a chance. You have both a chance that he misses, or you have a chance
he doesn't hit it that well and can make it back in the point. Yeah.
It's not a thing. When he's hitting it early and timing it so beautifully, you're toast anyway.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter what you're doing. But no, I wanted to see if you wanted to mention the miss.
The miss. Yes, yeah, yeah. The I mean, I miss. Thought yeah, I mean, so I actually, this is the only thing where I wrote stuff down. I think I was thinking about it, and I feel like this miss is kind of almost misunderstood, because I think the way most people look at it is big point, didn't get to 40-15, missed opportunity. But I was rewatching this match, and the way I kind of saw it was, so that break point at 3-2, Djokovic hits a central inside-out forehand, Nadal hits a forehand down the line, forces the error. And like you can finally see at this point in the match, Djokovic is slipping a little bit. Like he's lost enough in the legs that Nadal is finally getting some time on the forehand. And you're kind of reminded, like, oh yeah, like Nadal's forehand like demolishes short balls. And then the first point of that 4-2 game, again, Djokovic like hits a backhand that lands around the tee, and Nadal demolishes it, winner easily. I remember like Patrick McEnroe was like, all of a sudden Nadal's ball is like exploding off the court. And I'm like, not really. It's just like, he has time. Like this is what happens when he has time. But, and then after that at 30-15, Djokovic approaches Nadal's forehand with this crappy inside out forehand. Like the wheels have come off tactically now. Like he's finally letting Nadal do what he wants. Like cardinal sin number one, hit short to the forehand, he's done that twice in the last 4 points. And number two is shitty approach to the forehand. And he does that. And what I think this miss does is it kind of jolts Djokovic out of that. And he's like, okay, I need to refocus because I still have a chance in this game. Because I think there was maybe a moment there where Nadal could have like swept by him. Because when Djokovic starts to stray from this game plan, I mean, not like it was a conscious thing, just that like he's lost enough physically that his shot quality is suffering. I feel like maybe Nadal could have put the match away. And I think this miss, more than anything, arrests his momentum. Because from 30 all serving, you should still hold. So I think, I mean, it's not like this was game point or break point, like it's 30-15. That's not, in the grand scheme of things, a massive point. And I think what it did was snaps Djokovic back into it. And then he quickly gets the break back with two amazing shots. What did you think of it?
I thought that was great. I hadn't really thought about it that way, but I think it is. He does that with Djokovic sometimes, where he just loses the plot and starts doing crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And sometimes he doesn't reset and then he loses. But yeah, you're right. I think he looked terrible at this moment in time. It looked like, oh, this is going to be 5-2 in a little bit.
Right.
The funny thing is, this is one of the famous misses in tennis history. I was convinced that it was at 40-15. I thought it was game point.
Right. Yeah.
I realized, no, it's actually 30-15. Would have been 40-15 if he hits this. And man, I took a screen cap of it, and it's so bad.
Like, yeah.
Djokovic isn't even in that service square.
Yeah. I mean, he could have hit it closer to the tee than the sideline on that side of the court and would have had a winner.
He just completely rushed.
Yeah.
And you can see that his feet are like everywhere, the wrong position. He just rushed. He just got ahead of himself.
And the sad thing is, like, he think at first, for like a moment, he thought he made it. Like, he clenches his fist and then he goes like, oh crap, that was out, and challenges.
I think they were both kind of delirious at this point.
Yeah.
I don't think they knew what they were doing.
And the crazy thing is, like, of all things that you could mess up, it's a passing shot. Like, Nadal is the best the passer court. In history. Like, this is miles easier than like half a dozen passing shots he hit against Federer in the semis. Like, oh, for my sure. God. It's crazy.
It was a terrible volley.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a dreadful volley.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching this point. Like, I was surprised Nadal didn't pass him cleanly with the first forehand. Because, like, again, this was a dreadful approach shot. Like, Nadal's all the time in the world. And, like, and he does enough, because Djokovic, it's a volley that sets up. It should have been, like, taking candy from a baby. And, yeah.
There was nothing. I remember when this happened, thinking, oof. And yeah, and I think you're right. He probably, if you ask Djokovic, he'd probably agree with you that, because he's, like you said, he's different after this.
Yeah.
It's when he gets his break back, he's different.
Oh.
Like, the way he holds, the way he breaks, like that, he's a different player. It's like he snapped out of it. And remember, his reaction was kind of like how when he lost the break in the second set.
Like, yeah. It's
back to business, back to doing the things we do well. And that was it. But I mean, yeah, maybe Nadal goes up 40-15, maybe he loses the next point too. But I do think that sometimes when you give players that, when you crack the door open just a little bit, you give them that get out of jail moment where they think, oh shit, that was a gift. Yeah, and I'm looking at the string cap and I'm like, how does he miss that? It hurts. Like, he has half the court wide open.
So I gotta ask, Nadal wins this point. Does he win the match?
If this is 40-15 and this is to hold, yes.
You think? So you think?
Yes.
Because I'm trying to picture him serving it out, and I'm just like, there's no way that game would not at least go to deuce. Like,
oh, for sure.
And there's no way that would have been an easy hold. I kind of think the same thing about Wimbledon 2018. Like, if he breaks it 7-all, I mean, like, it was a big point, but I'm still like, I don't know if he serves that out. Like,
yes, I mean, that's a fair. We don't know. I think if this, like I said, if this is 40-15, he misses this, and this could have been 5-2 right away.
Yeah.
But against the greatest returner of all time, who all he needs is for Nadal to miss first serves and he's in. Yeah, I don't know. Like, was it a huge miss? It was a huge miss.
Yeah.
But was it a, like, atrocious? I really think if this had been 40-15 and this is game point, then you would have, I think there's more of a leg to stand on that. Yes, this was such a huge thing, because you go up 5-2 and then you have a chance to return.
Right.
And at this point, Nadal has all the momentum. Djokovic is looking gassed. He's looking lost. Like you said, he's doing crazy tactical things. That's where Nadal probably wins at 6-2. if he holds after this
point. Even after Djokovic has to sit down for a couple of minutes, like eat some gluten-free dates. And
well, that's the thing. He's holding. Yeah, you're right. Djokovic would have had time to regroup, but then he kind of has to feel the pressure of being 2-5 and knowing
best case, you have to serve to stay in the match twice.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're in trouble.
Yeah. I think like I don't know if I'm quite ready to say like 40-15 he wins the match. I think if he gets to 5-2, Nadal wins from there.
Probably.
But
I mean, he needed to get to 5-2. You want to get to that 5-2 because you get two chances to break for the match.
Yeah.
If you don't serve it out. And he could.
Yeah.
What a miss. But yeah, that's funny. All these years have gone by, and I was I was so sure that it was 40-15 that when it happened, it surprised me.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh crap, that was it.
Right.
And I watched it again, and even the commentator was kind of like, he missed that.
Yeah.
He missed that. He's standing right at the service line almost. Just, oh my God. Because Djokovic didn't even cover it. He wouldn't even fake him out.
He had given up on the point. Yeah.
He's done.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Poor Nadal. And I like how no one mentions the roof situation in this match, although there really isn't controversy because it's
right.
Because
that was right after the epic hold, right? Like,
yes.
Yeah. I mean, and that moment actually is one of my favorite rain match. Yeah. Because after he holds, there are a few moments when the crowd is still losing their shit after this escape. And you don't quite know what's going to happen. And Nadal, like, after he's done his chainsaw thing, he's like walking in a circle, and then he like turns back towards the court and he switches his racket to his right hand so he can pump his left fist again. And this is like, at this point, this is like 20 seconds after the point has ended and the crowd is chanting Rafa. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is madness. Like that was so crazy. And he's gritting his teeth and oh my God.
He looks like Kobe when he had that weird like jaw thing. He looks well, and also we should talk about how Nadal wins the fourth set and drops to his knees.
Yeah, right. Like, I mean, one of my biggest what ifs. I mean, next to like, if the changeover had gone off a year earlier, and you did live analysis of this, but is like, how does Nadal celebrate winning this match? Like,
I don't know, because there's a point later in the fifth set where they play this insane match, and Nadal like barely celebrates. Because at that point, there's like, there's no.
There's nothing there's left. Nothing. Like you can't even Nadal is not going to waste energy celebrating. Yeah, I mean, and the crazy thing about that point where Djokovic like crumples to the ground is like, I don't even think Nadal looks over and sees that. Like I think he's facing the other way the entire time. Like does that change things if he sees Djokovic like the dead starfish after this 32 shot rally?
Well, and it seems like he's even crying or something. He just looks brutal. Riley at 15-3-4.
Oh wait, no, that was an earlier one actually. Because after that one, Djokovic starts to smile.
I didn't put the score in the 31 because I did put 31 shots and everything was a haymaker. Djokovic collapses after badly hitting a backhand. Nadal barely celebrates. He was just walking.
Yeah.
He's just gonna walk.
I mean,
plays just fist and that was it.
Yeah, I mean, so another take I have from this match is like Nadal at this tournament, like this. The fittest tennis player ever. Like, I mean, because it's wild. Like he just does one fist pump, like doesn't even vamos. And Djokovic, like, not only does he fall back, but when he's getting ready for the next point, he is like visibly sucking air into his lungs. It's like you can hear him thinking, like, I gotta do this enough times so I can like put a serviceable swing on the ball. And the hilarious thing is, after he loses the 15 love point, drops his racket. And he bends down to pick it up and he drops it again twice. Like the first time he tries to grab it and kind of drops it again. And then the same thing, like it takes him three tries to pick up his racket. Like you can see him fumbling with it like a child. Like he's gone. And I think Nadal takes a little longer to crack physically. I mean, Djokovic had the longer semi, but I'm like, again, this was a thing I wrote like in that Nadal piece. I'm like, Nadal looks like he wanted to keep playing. Like he's still running like a madman in the last game. Like there's one point where his shot like clips the net and sits up and he ends up having to do like four back and forth sprints and then finally gets back into point. Like I mean, this match was physical for both of them, but I think what fails to get mentioned kind of is like Nadal does all the running. Like most of these points are Djokovic doing whatever he wants and Nadal is trying to stay in it somehow. It's
usually short point.
Yeah.
Short ball attack and Nadal's up down by the Melbourne letters.
Yeah. Like he spends most of the match by the Melbourne letters. Like it's crazy.
And it's hard. I mean, that reminds me of the 2009 US Open final when Del Potro beat Federer.
Yeah.
Like in that match, you could tell that one player was doing a lot of the running.
Yeah.
And at some point, it just doesn't become sustainable. Although, yeah. I mean, Federer had no chance, didn't even come close to what Nadal came close in the fifth. But yeah, at some point, it's just hard to win a match like that when you're just chasing everything and running everything. But yeah, I remember that. I had forgotten about Nadal celebration after the fourth set.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like he celebrated like when he won Madrid. Yeah. This is the fourth set.
Yeah. I mean, it's more emphatically than he celebrated winning the semi of this tournament. Like, and I think it's interesting because like that US Open third set, that was an amazing set. But I feel like in this fourth set, like, the reason why he's so amped kind of is like Djokovic played well. Like in that third set of the US Open, Djokovic was up a break like three times and kept giving it back. But in this one, like Nadal never had a break point. He's down 3-4, love 40, just three times, 2 points away from losing the match, and he wins the set. And I feel like you can hear him thinking like, okay, I can do it. I can beat this guy when he's playing well. And he just goes nuts. I mean, and this is something I wish the camera had focused on, is like for just a second when it's still the court view and you see Nadal go down to his knees, you can see Djokovic look to his box for a second, you know, sometimes. So after he loses a set, he just looks to them like he can't believe what's happening. And it's like, he's thinking, oh my God, I have to do this for another hour. like, I don't know if I can do this. And he almost couldn't. Yeah.
That was, yeah. And the funny thing is, talking about celebrations, I feel like this is the match where the Nadal fans definitely turned on Djokovic, because before 2011, it was more of a like, oh, he's cute and, you know, not really a threat. I mean, Djokovic had never beaten him in a final. It was just, you know, it's this guy, whatever. Then 2011 happened and they were shook.
Oh, yeah.
But then this one is where I think it turned, because obviously Nadal came so close.
Yeah.
But then for some reason, Djokovic's celebration just rankled so many feathers.
But like, come on, what do you, after that, like he could. Well, that was do always my point. Wants. Like,
exactly. After I mean, that point,
maybe
I
if
would
he
have
wins
taken
in
off
straight.
All my clothes.
Right.
I would have taken off all my clothes and I wouldn't have cared what would happen. I would have had to have been, you know, rushed by security.
Yeah,
but they just hated that he tore the shirt and that he was thumping his chest. Like,
yeah,
I'm a big fan of, you know, even if he's taunting, which he was not. When you lose, you lose.
Yeah,
you know, you have to take it. That's it. And I think, I don't know if they thought that he was taunting, but.
He didn't look at Nadal once. Like,
no, he's not thinking at all. What he's telling, my read of that was, obviously, he's not thinking.
Yeah,
this is just primal energy. But if there is a thought process, it was more of a, I survived this.
I can do anything. Like,
I can do anything. Yeah. And also, all these people who said I was frail, all these people who said I can't fight, this is for them. And he's telling his team, yes. We are strong enough. We've overcome because we survived that.
Yeah.
And somehow that drove Nadal fans crazy. And I never understood it. And I watched it again. That's like my favorite Djokovic style celebration.
Yeah.
Because falling on the ground, I mean, that's just generic. So.
Oh, I don't know. That's my favorite. I can't get enough of that. Like,
I don't know. I think Federer does that better than most people, but most people fall to the ground when they win something. So for me, my favorites are actually when he does not do that. My favorites are when this one, where, I mean, he falls to the ground. Yes. And then he has that maniacal, it's a great shot, like from the top.
Yeah.
And he looks like a wild creature.
Yeah.
But then, you know, handshake, whatever. And then he just goes and rips the shirt off, which is kind of like a two-part celebration. I love this one. The Wimbledon one of just walking to net with that smirk after beating Federer.
it's just the biggest screw you to the crowd.
And then the one at the 2015 US Open against Federer. Yes. I love when he just, when he doesn't fall to the ground and does, well, in this one, he actually did fall to the ground. I mean, who wouldn't have fallen to the ground after that? But it's funny how he has that like moment where he's completely wild, completely feral.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't last very long.
Right.
It's kind of like he comes out of it, remembers that he has to go through the protocol.
Yeah.
And then he just completely lives off.
Yeah.
And then he has that same insane energy. Yeah. And it also that made me think of that. I think that on some level, that also kind of frightened people.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
like this guy is, and that's whenever he screams, people like get freaked out.
Right. The screams against Berrettini at the Roland Garros.
Those were hilarious.
I was laughing, but I was also like, I mean, because I think after the second one, he went again, and I was like, "Oh, he's still going!" Like, and I just thought it was hilarious. But like, who wants to play against that, man? Like, it's frightening.
Yes, and I think for fans, I don't know if they thought, well, you know, with Federer being all genteel and tennis in general being all like, you know, kind of a dainty sport, and it all has that physicality. But I don't know that he frightens you in a way that when Djokovic is like that. Frightens you, because Nadal doesn't have that anger. It's always more like
just passion. Like, and it's not necessarily pointed at anyone. It's like it's very
pure competitive spirit.
Yeah, it's very insular. Like, and Djokovic, it feels like it's pointed at someone, like his opponent or the crowd, especially if you don't like him.
The universe, life.
Yeah,
but it's just this energy that is not rational, and it's just so strong that it makes me kind of understand why people don't warm up to him, because that is a side of humanity that I think people want to pretend like doesn't exist.
Yeah. I mean, these reactions, like from both of them, I could watch this like on loop for hours, because like because Djokovic like gets up and like for a second, he like, you don't really see this much because it pans to Nadal for a second, but he like screams at his box and kind of wiggles his arms a little bit. And while he's doing that, Nadal, like, I mean, usually after a match, someone is like shattered and crying. Like when you see Federer walk to the net, it's like head down, like takes the bandana off. And the one second you see Nadal, it's like bottom teeth out. He's like he also looks like very feral. Like he's just, I mean, he doesn't look sad. He just looks like so angry that he's managed to lose this match. It's like the angriest I've ever seen him. Like he can't believe it. And you just have this one second when like Nadal's gritting his teeth, like he wants to shatter them, and Djokovic is roaring at the heavens. It's perfect. And I mean, the entire last game I love, but I also love how ironic the last point is, because it's like after 6 hours of grueling rallies, it's like huge serve, inside out winner, like good night. You know, I mean, it's almost like Djokovic is thinking, this has already gone on for like an hour longer than it should have. Like, this is not going to go for a second longer than it has to, because even in this game, he goes from 30 love to 30-40. Like, he should have held to 15 or something.
Yes.
And it's hilarious. And that this match is why I kind of have this rule now that's not logical, but I'm like, if a match is competitive enough, I expect like a fight in the last game. Like when, you know, the Indian Wells final this year with Azarenka and Badosa.
Didn't see it, but yeah, I heard that it was.
Yeah. But in the third, Azarenka breaks and then she's serving for it at 5-4 and she goes up 30 love. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, there's no way something else is going to happen. Like, and then she made 4 straight errors and went on to lose the match. But I'm just like, I just feel like some matches like are going to refuse to end quietly through some like manifestation of the tennis gods or something. And this was one of them.
Well, in 2015 US Open, Djokovic Federer final also. That's 6-2 in the fourth.
Because three break points in the last game.
Got broken and then had all those break points. And then it ended. It should have ended. Yeah, I think, yes. This was a fun match for those purposes. Like at the end of the fourth, beginning of the fifth, I mean, those guys are in a place that I really don't think is rational. Yeah. I mean, at the end of in that last game, Djokovic is like talking to the heavens, like he's having a real conversation.
Yeah, I mean, he's praying, he's crying. Like when he holds to get back to 4-all, he like kisses his cross. And this is not this is not like a peck. He's making out with the thing. Like
this is not performative either. This is
right.
It's like neither of them are even involving the crowd. It's like nothing exists beyond this. They're so in the moment.
Yeah.
They've forgotten everything.
Yeah.
They don't have any more energy, any more bandwidth. They don't have nothing. They have nothing to give to anybody but each other and against the other.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the fifth set, people should watch the fourth and fifth set, which actually is not that long, right? Like
fourth set is 88 minutes, fifth is 76. So that'd be an hour 52, something like that, 54.
Yeah, I mean, you know, 2 hours is definitely more manageable than six.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, definitely.
Yeah, watching the fourth and the fifth is time well spent for sure.
And I mean, we should say people watching on YouTube, if you watch it on your phone, tap on the side, you can fast forward 15 seconds. Yes. And on your computer, your cursor arrows will take you 5 seconds.
Right.
And you will enjoy it a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the matches where like I don't remember exactly how I felt, but I must have been just like blown away, where I was in that phase like going through all these old matches and being like, oh, that existed, like this one existed, like how cool. And I think when I came across this one, I must have just been like, oh my god, I can't believe like this is part of history that we get to enjoy. Like, I mean, like you were saying, it is kind of like towards the end everything vanishes except for them, like in that 4-all rally. I swear it's like the world stops spinning for that 55 seconds or whatever. And that, do you remember that horrible joke of smash at 30-15 in the last game? I mean, that's got to be like the least surprising miss ever, right? Like it didn't even feel like an unforced error, because it's like legs are dead, good lob, had to jump for it, pressure. Like, I mean, it went into the bottom quarter of the net, and I don't think anyone was that surprised. Like,
no. The surprise is that that was the only one he hit in the whole match.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Nadal, actually, they ended Nadal up with, has one. Like,
yes, yeah. They ended up at 1-all in Djokovic smashes.
Yeah, I mean, which is...
Well, Nadal was hard, too. Nadal blew one from... It was a baseline overhead.
Yeah, yeah.
It was very deep, but he doesn't miss those.
Right.
But he completely blew that one.
And that felt brutal, too, because he set it up with a forehand down the line, which, like, I don't know that he got to hit more than, like, seven of those all match, because it just never had time. Which is one of the reasons why that hold in the fourth was so crazy, because that first break point starts with a second serve and he kind of has to trade blows for a little bit. And then finally he gets a backhand slice, which sets up the forehand. And that first inside out forehand comes about 2 inches away from going long. But it's in and it sets up the second one, which is a winner. And it's like how he had the patience to do that when he was clearly screwed. In all facets of the match, I'll never know. Like that was wild.
That first break point in that 3-4 in the fourth set, that is the one, the only one that Djokovic, he didn't even make a mistake. He made a slight tactical mistake, because they play that rally, and there's a shot where Djokovic has a backhand lineup, and it's not the most comfortable one. But instead of going cross court, he kind of goes not down the line, because he's not even standing on the line.
Right.
He goes straight at Nadal, and Nadal just takes the invitation and hits the first inside out forehand.
That's right.
And I'm thinking that, wonder what happens if he just hits that cross court.
Yeah.
Because I think he thought, I mean, and that's the dynamic. That's the same thing. He thought he could get away with a crappy shot to Nadal's forehand back inside. But he didn't realize that Nadal was right there. So Nadal didn't have to do that much to run around. And also his backhand was not very good, because he was out of position. He was off balance. But that's a slight tactical error. And Nadal did everything else to survive that.
Yeah.
That was this was fun. I mean, it's just fun watching tennis and not dealing with our stupid current timeline. So
yeah. Yeah.
This was enjoyable. And 10 years, I wonder, what do you think the legacy of this match is, if it even has a legacy?
I mean,
it has a very obvious one.
Right.
The stupid shot clock.
Yeah. I mean, could be the recency bias of talking about it, but I think most important match of the era. Like, if Nadal wins this, he gets the double slam. That's his 11th major. I think he would never have to listen to another clay specialist argument ever again if he wins this match. He would have had to win the second U.S. Open.
Second U.S. Open.
So I guess in this timeline, we'll assume that still happens. But I think also this stretch for Djokovic, because he had just come off that U.S. Open where that proved mentally he could do anything with those match points. And this one kind of immediately after proved physically he could do anything. And so I kind of wonder what would happen if he didn't win this one, because maybe that would plant like a little bit of a seed mentally. Like maybe when he goes up against Nadal, he's still physically a little bit weaker.
The funny thing is, for me, at the time, it didn't seem like it. I felt like this was a continuation of 2011, and I was so excited.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, this year, the next year, 2013, and 2014, those were, in a way, I mean, obviously, 2009, 2010 were really bad years to follow Djokovic. Really bad years. Because, I mean, 2008 even had some moments. 2010 was dreadful.
Right.
But 2012, 2013, 2014, he won a slam in each of them.
Yeah.
But only the one.
It felt like he was underachieving, like looking back. I mean,
yes.
I mean, 2012 went on to be like an average year for him. Like, I remember you wrote in your US Open like preview for him, like, this is inexplicable that he lost that final. Like, I mean,
the one against Murray?
Yeah. I mean, that was peak Andy and everything. But I mean,
no.
Yeah.
Just because of the wind.
Yeah.
Because it was windy. Too much to ask.
I remember reading your line. It's like he allowed his imperious form to be interrupted by, and then it was like an ellipsis, and it was like the wind. It's like, I mean, yeah. Like
the wind.
And that Wimbledon semi loss to Federer is one of his worst. Like,
yeah, he actually was kind of out of that match by the start of the third.
Yeah.
Whichever said he was not very, because even the set that he won was kind of like
it was one of those you feel like it's not going to go.
This is not going to end up in anything. No, and then basically those three seasons made everyone think 2011 was indeed an aberration.
Yeah,
that was the year that everything aligned, and something special had to happen for this guy who, again, now he's a known quantity, especially in big matches. But back then he was not.
Yeah.
He was not. You didn't know. You hoped that he would be what he could be,
mm-hmm.
play up to his potential. But you never knew what was going to derail him, because the one that he loses against Murray, actually, that's a match I didn't even see. I think I've seen the end. That was a dumb scheduling thing. But the wind was such a stupid situation, because the Ferrer match, which was the semi, he loses the first at 6-2. For no reason other than the wind. No reason. It's just the wind. It was windy.
Yeah.
He was losing his mind and playing terribly because it was windy. And then it wasn't windy, and he won 1-4-2.
Right. I mean, and he let that happen again against Thiem in the Roland Garros semis in 2019. Like, he let that
Another
first set go without even fighting for it. I mean, I don't think he would have won the final, but that was his last chance at four in a row. I guess this year, but the last year, but that... That was tougher in retrospect. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think people forget as well that before Wimbledon 2014, he had a losing record in major finals, which seems unimaginable now. Now he's the match player.
And before Wimbledon 2014, that was when you were thinking, because 2012, 2013, at the end of the year, we're like, well, at least he did win his one slam, right?
Yeah.
But 2014, he loses at the Australian Open to Stan in a very dumb match point.
Oh my god. And and the second last point as well.
I don't remember that one. I just remember the serve and volley.
Vavrinka shanks a return, and it ends up as like a shitty drop shot. And Djokovic gets there in plenty of time, and he slices the dink wide when like when anything would have worked. And I remember people flipped out on commentary, and then he followed it up with an even worse miss on the next point. I mean, that's the only time when he's truly blown a close match, right?
Like, well, and remember, I think that's when I think 2014 is when he hired Boris Becker, and then that happens at the Australian Open. And I was joking, you know, like, okay, this is going to be a very short appointment.
Right.
But then that's the year he wins his second Wimbledon.
Yeah.
And that's the year when, I mean, in 2015 is 2015 and then 2016. Yep. And then you're like, okay, it was not an aberration. This guy is actually can be that good.
Yeah.
When he gets through it. And, you know, we now know what he is.
Yeah.
But back then, that's the thing that people, when they think back on matches, they tend to forget what the players were at that time.
Right.
And I did expect Djokovic to, well, that's the thing. I expected Djokovic to show up for this final because even as shambolic as he was in the semis against Murray, this was against Nadal, who had just, you know, it just beaten six straight times.
Right.
But I don't think that most matches after this, I felt. Well, the one thing I will mention that people also forget, because it's like a little footnote, that Nadal got a nice and completely random and unfortunate assist to finally break the streak against Djokovic.
Was that Djokovic's grandfather, right?
His grandfather died. Yeah. And this was like a very important figure in his life.
Yeah.
And you could see that final.
He wasn't.
Because I think he didn't die before the final. I think he died before between the quarters and the semis, and he made it to the final. But that's what I was also talking about, the whole mental thing.
Yeah.
Physically, he was perfect.
Right.
But if you're mentally, you don't have it, like he didn't have it at all in the US Open final. Like he ran out. Yeah. He was out. Physically, he was fine. If you don't have the mentality, the mental gas to be able to focus and so that you can fight, you can't compete.
Right.
And in that one, you know, not always like, well, can't say right place, right time, because he was always there.
Right. But yeah, I mean, eight in a row.
He was always there. So that you can't say that was lucky that he was there. No, he wasn't lucky. He was always there. But that's the one where I think, man, if that doesn't happen, because Nadal obviously, because people always say, look, player A plays player B and player B is hurt and player A wins. And people say, well, that doesn't matter in the long run for player B because he was hurt. Mm-hmm. And player A has to know that. But what they don't realize is that winning generates confidence.
Like
getting the win, even if you know, like, yeah, his grandfather died. No. This win on top of how I played in Australia, on top of how I played the US Open, like, okay. And also remembering all the mini wins he had before.
Right.
But that's one where, that's one of those little nuggets that gets forgotten. And after that, Nadal was off to the races, right? Like, you should have won 6 out of 7 or?
I think so, yeah. I mean, including that Monte Carlo one, I think it was 6 out of 7. But yeah, I mean, with these two, I think like a little bit when Federer is involved, but not as much. It's like, I mean, it's almost weird because like their peak level is so high and they're the only one who can really match it. Like, but like you get a lot of blowouts, ironically, because it's like, if you don't show up with everything going right, like you're going to get completely run over. Which is why you got that rematch 7 years later, which, in the 2019 final, which I'm kind of still mad at because I was expecting a close match. And the night before I was like hanging out with some friends. And the host goes like, hey, do you all want to sleep over? And under normal circumstances, I'd be like, yeah, sure. But I'm like, no, man, like I can't miss this match. And so I go home and I get up at 3 a.m. and it's, I mean, Djokovic was amazing, but at this point I didn't really like him. I didn't really understand why he was so good. And so I was like, and what is going on? Like, Rafa, what are you doing? And it was just a miserable watch. Cause I was expecting like a sequel, but yeah, I mean, it's weird because like they're so evenly matched in so many ways, but it's also like, if if one thing is faltering, like blowout. So
yes, they have to be. The funny thing about that stretch after the Djokovic 7 in a row is that the next 5 were on clay. And out of those, Djokovic only won the Monte Carlo one that you were talking about.
Right.
That he played amazing. But then Nadal beats him at the French, which is the when Djokovic was up 4-2 and blew his advantage.
Yeah.
Which I never really, and it was kind of actually, it was kind of similar to this situation where I didn't feel like Djokovic played well that match.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like that match was all that good, to be honest.
Yeah.
It was a slog. It was probably the clay twin of the 2012 final.
Yeah,
and also people think about it as a final when it actually was the semifinal.
Right. Poor Ferrer.
Everyone knew it was gonna to either of them. And yeah, and then the funny thing is after that French Open one, which Djokovic could not translate the recent Monte Carlo, Nadal beats him in Canada and beats him at the US Open. And the Canada one I didn't see, but that was 7-6 in the third.
Yeah.
And the US Open one I obviously did see. Mm-hmm. I don't think Djokovic was in that match at all.
No, like I mean it's kind of crazy that he even, because he had love 40 at 4-all in the third. And it's kind of like a twin of that Wimbledon semi with Federer, because that one as well, he had a break point at 4-all in the third. Like he had a chance to go up in that match, and it kind of ended up being a blowout in the end. But yeah, I mean I vividly remember reading like your live recaps of these matches, and the French Open one, I remember you were like, the entire time you're like, Djokovic is not using the right tactics. Like he's not trying to put Nadal in backhand jail, and he's not hitting his backhand down the line. And so I remember you were kind of astonished that he even went off a break in the fifth. I remember a phrase you used was like, it was lopsided for a 9-7 in the fifth match, which is like, which is such a like paradoxical thing to say, but it was true because, I think Nadal won like 60% of his second serve points or something. And in this 2012 final, he wins like 40 something. I don't know.
Yeah, no, their rivalry is, I'm just happy that they gave us the Wimbledon semi.
Yeah.
Which is to me clearly their best match.
Yeah, that's the crown jewel. Yeah.
And then the French Open semi, which I mean, that third set, and actually the first set is pretty underrated because the first set at the beginning, they start so well.
Yeah, I mean, the first two games are amazing. Yeah.
And then, you know, that all just goes up 5-0. You're thinking, oh, crap.
Yeah.
But it actually starts really well. Yeah. But then second set, it's a little bit, but then the third set. But they have at least given us more. And at the time, I don't know that we thought that that was even going to be possible.
Yeah.
Because so many of those matches afterwards were not that competitive. Mm-hmm. If you look at them. Well, that in 2014, 2015, that's when Djokovic went on his crazy streak against Nadal on hard, where he was just, well, and then on clay even, where he would just not even give him a set.
Not even in
exhibitions.
Yeah, and I remember watching highlights of these matches, and it was kind of like, before I understood what was going on, but it was like this dynamic in the 2012 final where like, Nadal just can't do anything. I'd be like, Nadal, what are you doing? Like you're playing every point the way Djokovic wants. Like you're getting killed. Hit your forehand down the line. But like I didn't realize like he can't. You know, it's not a feasible possibility with how much time he has. And I think that's something that like took me a while to understand about Nadal's forehand is like when he gets time, it's like the best or equal with Federer's. Like there's this point in I think to go up double set point in the first set where like serve out wide, Djokovic hits like a mediocre return, and then Nadal hits like an inside out bomb, and then a baseline smash, and then a cross court bomb, and then finishes with a volley. And it's like, yeah, when it has time, like you are screwed. But it's actually not that hard to deprive it of time. It's just that like hard to do it sustainably for a long period of time. Like not everyone has a Djokovic backhand. You're gonna start missing eventually.
No, because the way you. I mean, Nadal, and that's the funny thing about Nadal and Federer is that they kind of like to operate from the same part of the court.
Yeah.
Running around their backhands. But, and the way you screw them is you don't let them do that and force them to hit backhands. so that they don't have time or they feel like they have to run around and force it and you mess their whole rhythm. And yeah, that's the thing. And the other thing is when Djokovic, when Nadal sometimes, that's one thing. I don't know if you noticed in this match, I didn't feel like Djokovic defended the down the line Nadal forehand all that well. Like, like these later on in the rivalry, it feels like Djokovic resets a lot of those points.
Yeah.
But in this one, I don't think he reset any of them. Some of them he couldn't even put it back in play.
Yeah, I think part of it was like, I mean, there's one weird one like early in the first set where Nadal hits one and it's not all that good, but Djokovic doesn't even chase it. But I think part of it was that he knew that like it was unlikely enough that it was coming that he didn't even need to cover it and he could just give Nadal the space. Because I'm watching it and it's like, again, I don't think he hits more than like a handful of them. So like when he does, Djokovic can kind of be like, okay, like I'll give that to you because I know you can't do it sustainably.
I'll live with that. I mean, yeah. Contrast that with the Wimbledon semi where Nadal hits million of those.
And it's crazy because that's better than he's ever hit it and he loses the match. I mean, sometimes I feel like Nadal's, I mean, this was something I thought about putting in that piece I wrote about him. Sometimes it feels like his intensity almost works against him sometimes and helps his opponents peak. Like I don't know how to explain it, but it's like, I don't know if there's any player who loses more when they're playing really well, if that makes any sense. Like sometimes it feels like he plays really well. It's, and his opponent just kind of inexplicably peaks and beats him anyway.
Well, I mean, it happened to Federer in that 2019 final at Wimbledon, because Federer was
the semi player. Yeah,
the whole, well, the Nadal one I didn't see, but against Djokovic, like he was a better player the whole match.
Yeah,
except for the tie breaks.
Oh my god, that match. I mean, that like how so... oh my god. So this I mean, I'll tell you a fun story about this. I mean, this was kind of like it, like ironically, that this was sort of what like made me more neutral, I guess. But like before it happened, I was like pro Federer, anti Djokovic. And I mean, so I didn't see this match. I was at a camp abroad, but I knew what was happening and I knew Federer had no chance. But I'm still invested. So I'm like, I gotta find out what the score is. And so I ask this counselor, and the counselor goes, okay, first set 7-6 Djokovic. Second set 6-1, and I was like, oh shit, this is less close than I thought it would be. And then he goes 6-1 Federer, and I'm like, oh okay, like something might be happening here. And then I see, and I was following the live score when Federer blew the match points, and as soon as I see it change to 8-all, I'm like, that's it, he's lost. And then finally at the end of the trip, I like read the whole live recap, and I'm like, my god, he was ahead in the first set tiebreak, and he had set point in the third set, and like, and how did he lose this match? Like, oh my god. I mean, like Brian Phillips wrote this crazy good piece about it. But like you mentioned him in like the first podcast we did, and I like checked out his work. Like he's a crazy good writer. I love his work. Yes. But he was like, okay, I just completely lost my train of thought, but he wrote this amazing piece about it. And like Federer led all the sets and everything, and just lost the match. And I'm just like, how? Oh yeah, and he had this line where he was like, if you knew their history, chances are you never fully believed Federer could win, even when he had the match points. I'm like, yeah, like that's tragic, but it's completely true.
But the funny thing is I bailed on that match.
Yeah, I remember you wrote about it in your shot piece, and you're like, I think you said you took your daughter to the pool.
I literally took my daughter to the pool, and I was so much happier in the pool with my kid, and she was having a great time. And I think I checked the score on my phone. I was like, they're in the fifth set. And then I think we went back home. Mm-hmm. Not even because of the match. We went back home because it was time. And then I saw that they were in the tiebreaker. Yeah. So I completely missed that Federer had the match points. Later, wow. I found out, and I was like, oh, that's hilarious. So I did see the two. I think I did see the tiebreaker, like the end. And I remember being completely anticlimactic because I thought it was to 10.
Right.
I thought it was a super tiebreaker. And then they say it ended at 7th room. What? It ended? It's over? And on a shank, too.
Like, yeah. Oh, my God. And
which pretty fitting, honestly, for that match.
And the like, did you know they replayed the last point? Because basically, like, Federer, the first time they play the 6-3 point, Federer's on the attack. And Djokovic hits a really short ball. And it's called out. And right after that, Federer kind of slaps a backhand into the net. And then Djokovic challenges, and it's in. And I think he's annoyed he didn't get the point. But then they replay it, and Federer just immediately shanks a forehand, like off his best shot too.
Yes.
Oh, like my lord! Like the way some of this stuff happens is completely inexplicable. Like I thought for a while, after kind of learning about all Djokovic's great escapes, I'm like, does he do this on purpose? Like, does he just walk as close to the cliff as he can to like see what crazy situations he can work his way out of?
I don't know, man. He wasn't always like this, but once he developed a taste for it,
yeah,
I think it's just the confidence of not freaking out.
Mm-hmm.
He gained so much confidence that he in himself that all of us he knows that he's not out until he's out.
Yeah.
And he can, because that's the thing, most humans would be out, are out. You see it in tennis all the time.
Yeah.
Players are out after one set, players are out after a set and a half. And in the big matches, not always, because there are plenty where he did go away. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of these, he just doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, and talk about extreme situations, like facing match points on Federer serve twice. It's
about as little control as you can possibly have.
One of the best servers ever.
Yeah.
On hard and grass.
Oh, not even God. Clay. And Federer, he makes first serves on 3 out of those 4 points.
Yeah. He only missed the... Which one did he miss?
The first one at Wimbledon. Yeah,
because the 2 at the US Open were first serves, and the other one at Wimbledon was the first serve. Yeah. So first serves from Federer on 3 of the 4. And you won all 4.
It's ridiculous. And the stuff he does against the crowd as well. Like another thing that was in that Brian Phillips article is he's like, I think maybe we like helped Djokovic become so strong because he knew once he couldn't count on our support, he had to figure out how to overcome us and his opponent. And then
what was it he said? He said something about how it's a great line. It's like, by wanting him to lose, we helped him win.
We helped him learn to win by wanting him to lose. Yeah, that was the last line of the piece. Yeah. I don't know, man.
Well, this was fun, my friend. I'm just so relieved. It just feels so good to talk about, like, tennis.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.